Hello, lovely listeners. A year since the 2016 election, so much remains dark. For this episode, Minnesotan, geographer, and plant mom Aileen Clark joins me to reflect on the year that was and to chat about where we go from here. We talk about Nasty Women, edited by Samita Mukhopadhyay and Kate Harding, and featuring essays by 23 incredible writers. Thanks for listening. Your support means so much. Together, let's read, resist, repeat.
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's raining outside. It's Sunday, so it's nice. We have candles, and we're recording in person, which is fabulous. Who are you for our listeners?
I'm Aileen Clark. I know Sarah.
And read things.
And I read things. And I live in D.C. too.
And so we're going to be talking about Nasty Women, and we're just going to kick it off now. First, I want to talk about why we chose to read this book. And so I asked you if you wanted to read it, so I'll go ahead and go first, which is basically that I was at a conference and it was $5 and I picked it up and Rhonda Girard, who's one of my favorite writers, was in a blurb on the back. So $5 plus Rhonda, and I was like, all right, I'm down for it. And then I read it and it was super powerful, so I wanted to talk about it on the show.
Yeah, and you messaged me about it and I was like, cool, this seems way less stressful than some of the other books that you have read. I feel like I can read this one and maybe speak to some of it. Yeah, it was kind of hard to find.
Yeah, and I mean, another thing I should mention is that we wanted to do it for this month because, of course, this is going to be released in November, about a year after last election. And so it seems like a very timely time to read the thoughts of 23 awesome women and talk about it with awesome women.
Can't believe it's been a year.
It's been a year, I know. So, anyway, gearing up for that.
Oh, man.
The first segment that we normally do on the show is staff recommendation. So, like in a bookstore where you see that cool shelf, what's your staff recommendation?
Oh, kind of late, but I read Station 11 finally.
Who's it by?
Emily St. John Mandel.
Okay.
Did you read that?
No. Tell us more.
It was not quite what I expected. It's kind of like a post-collapse of civilization, which also felt really terrifying to read at this time. I read it this summer. I read it during a lot of North Korea stuff, and I was like, oh,
yeah,
this feels possible. It is a stressful book, but it is actually a lot more like hopeful than you think. The main characters, there's a couple of them, and it goes between their lives from like right before civilization collapses, and then it's back and forth between that and now and how they're living now. But yeah, it was terrifying and also very good.
Do you read a lot of dystopia or?
No, I actually don't. It's not a thing I really normally pick up. I mean, I like read The Hunger Games and stuff, and that, I mean, I liked.
I'm trying to find a way into reading more fantasy because I find all of the conversations about especially people of color kind of writing in a fantasy genre really interesting, but I just kind of stopped with Tamara Pierce when I was 14.
Yeah.
That was it. And then, like, I read Dystopia, you know, as part of my unit in high school. And I really enjoyed it, but I just haven't really gone anywhere with it. So I'm always looking for recommendations.
You had a dystopia unit in high school?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, that's cool.
My English teacher was really, really bleak.
Yeah, we read Lord of the Flies, but I feel like everyone does that.
We actually didn't, but the other class did.
I mean, it's like pretty common.
Yeah.
Versus.
For sure. But I wish I'd read it because it's such a reference. But anyway, maybe I'm okay. It's just about a bunch of boys, right?
Like, yeah. I can imagine it'd be a lot more scary for me to read it now than it was when I was 16. When I was 16, it was just annoying.
I mean, we read 1984.
Oh, yeah. That would, again, an Animal Farm. I read those in high school, but did it register?
Yeah.
Like, clearly not.
I was just like, oh, this is
interesting. You're like, this is weird. The pigs are talking? Okay. I reread Brave New World as part of a book club a year ago. We did not really grasp this when we were in high school.
Okay, moving along. I want to provide a little bit of background about the book before we dive into it, just so listeners, if they haven't heard about it, kind of know what we're talking about. Basically, it's a collection of essays with 23 writers. I don't know, all of the superstar women I would expect to be in it are in it.
I did have to Google a lot of people.
I
like,
did too.
Not to say that I know who everyone is, because...
Definitely. Same thing, but there were also people where it's like, I follow you on Twitter. Oh, yeah. And so we'll dive into a little bit more of who's in here, since we're going to talk about a few essays in depth. But I thought the tagline on the back was interesting and just a good entryway, at least for me, into reading the book, which is just that when 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump and 94% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton, how can women unite in Trump's America? And in some ways, this book is a response to that. It has 23 writers who have all sorts of identities, all sorts of perspectives.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's an impressive spread.
It really is. And it's, in my mind, very intersectional, really exciting, lots of things I hadn't thought about and needed to think about.
I feel like I've seen a lot of these names before, and I'm sure a lot of them have already published things on the internet, but I don't find it as easy to read and process when it's on a screen. It's digestible because these are smallish essays about heavy topics.
Yeah.
Really helpful too.
I felt exactly the same way.
Because reading a whole book, something this thick about just one of these essays would be pretty overwhelming.
It would. I totally agree that having it in print was really helpful. So the first essay that we want to talk about was We've Always Been Nasty, Why the Feminist Movement Needs Trans Women and Gender Nonconforming Femmes. It's by Meredith Tallison. So basically in this piece, Meredith is speaking about the feminist movement and how it often, well, usually has excluded trans and non-gender conforming people and how that's really a problem. And then particularly looks at the ways that the feminist response to the election excluded trans and gender non-conforming people and how the Women's March did so as well, even while trying to fix that. I just found this piece really powerful. The writing is super strong. I have a couple quotes. The beginning of the piece, I think on the first page, Meredith is talking about the election, and she says, I wanted to be sad, but I was too angry. Over the weeks after Donald Trump's election, the anger steadily shifted towards alienation as I watched cisgender women across America find comfort in each other as they planned the Women's March in Washington. The way that she dissects the different emotions that she has at the beginning, I definitely have thought about my own kind of like response to the election and how I definitely was sad and angry too, but I never felt alienated, especially from the March on Washington because it was, you know, originally planned by Bob Land. Anyway, what did you think about the essay?
The first quote that you just read, I underlined this. Right after find comfort in each other as they planned the Women's March in Washington, an event that over time grew to emphasize emotional relief over radical action. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I like to think that I'm aware of trans and gender nonconforming femmes in political realms. Hearing it said from that person obviously hits a little harder than me knowing that they're there and feeling a little weird every time I see, like, a The Future is Female t-shirt. Okay, but, like, there's also other things.
Yeah. I guess for me, I felt like Meredith was speaking directly to me because at one point she says, first, trans people and non-gender conforming people were entirely excluded, and then later Raquel Willis and Janet Mock were added.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when I saw that they were added, my response was, oh, well, now they have trans women, which is basically what Meredith is saying,
right,
is that they are either tokenized or victimized by the feminist movement, TM, or whatever. So I actually felt that that was exactly what I did in response to hearing that they had joined, aside from being really excited because I love Janet Mock and Raquel Willis. I think it'll probably tie into the rest of our conversation anyway, but I wasn't at the Women's March. You were.
Yes.
I basically wasn't there because I had planned to be out of town. So it wasn't, and I know that a lot of people skip the march for various reasons, many of them valid. I didn't mean to skip it, and I would have been there, but I was out of town. I just say that I would have been there just because, again, I think this march was for me in so many ways.
Yeah.
So I want to be sure that I am explaining. It's not that I wasn't there because I had some particular issue that I was taking up with it. I just wasn't there. And so I don't know if you can speak to your experience being there at all, or...
Yeah, I mean, I think what Meredith talks about going back to it being more comforting and like, this is a thing we can do. I mean, it did do something. I don't want to say that it didn't. It only did something really in the numbers, in that size and spread of people. Because itself, I mean, we were just a lot of people in one place who were pissed off, but nothing really happened. I also, there were a lot of people. Like, I was in D.C., so there were a ton of people. I didn't get to see any speakers. I couldn't have. Eventually, we just could not move any farther. But yeah, and I mean, I definitely saw it while it was happening. Just people having, like, a lot of fun, and I was a little confused by that. But enjoying it, I'm not going to lie. Nice to not worry for, like, a hot sec. That's a pretty stark contrast to your Stonewalls and your Black Lives Matters. I mean, everyone's talked about this since then. I know this is nothing that you don't know. She mentions it later in the essay, too, about how headlines like, positivity as massive women's march makes voices heard in D.C. and no arrests made at peaceful women's march. No shit. It's cool to see 50-year-old ladies out there.
Really exciting to see
that. It's exciting to see that. But then you're like, well, of course no one got arrested because it's a bunch of 50-year-old white ladies. So yeah, I mean, I think shaping this essay around the Women's March was really good because a lot of people who are reading this book probably participated in some way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or at least engaged with the news of it. I think most people, even if they weren't there, were pretty heavily involved,
yeah,
at least intellectually, even if they didn't support it. One other thing I want to read from here that I felt like was kind of the thesis statement of the essay was basically, Meredith says, cisgender white women are deemed nasty when they behave in a way that challenges gender norms. But trans women and femmes' very existence is rooted in rebellion. And then the quote goes on to describe that really rich history of rebellion and revolution and protest. I don't really have anything to say about the quote because I think it says everything so well. But it was just a really big reminder to me that my own reaction to the Women's March, and especially the inclusion of Janet and Raquel, had some flaws, and also the necessity for trans women and non-gender conforming people to be recognized as leaders with unique experiences, not as people who have this marginal identity that can just be included with everything else, or again, victimized or tokenized. Okay, so the next essay that we want to talk about is There Ever a Right Time to Talk to Your Children About Fascism? It's by Kara Bolenik. And the title is pretty descriptive. Kara talks about being raised with knowledge of the Holocaust and her family's survival stories of the Holocaust, and then also her grandfather was in Gulag, persecution, basically, and anti-Semitism in her family. She says her mother was always talking about persecution, kind of thinking about it hand in hand with what Jewish identity means. She says at the end, I thought this was what it meant to be a Jew in the world, but this is how she was teaching us. It wasn't wrong exactly. So basically, doesn't remember being taught about the Holocaust for the first time. It was just part of her being and very much tied to her Jewish identity. And then now she is the mother of a Black son who she's trying to decide how to talk to about being Black in the world, especially as a white woman. And she wants to make sure that he feels empowered in his identity and knows his history, but also doesn't link Blackness necessarily to oppression. And she kind of dives into that in a much more nuanced way than I just described. But basically, I want to talk about this because I often think about how I will talk to my kids about race and about identity and about whiteness in particular, assuming that I'll have a child if I don't adopt who's at least partially white. And so I thought it was really interesting to read about her struggles of really wanting to make sure that her son was first of all safe, because that's really important too, and knew the threats that he might face, but also wasn't overburdened as she felt that she may have been by the way her mother taught her about her identity. I don't know if this essay like stood out to you in particular.
It did, but I'm not really part of any minority.
For me, like, yeah, part of my family is Palestinian. I want to make sure that my child knows about that because it's really important to who I am, even though at that point they will be, like, fourth generation. But it is really important to who I am and how I think about the world. But at the same time, I think a lot of what I'll be doing is talking to my child about what it means to be white and to carry that kind of cultural legacy. And so in a lot of ways, like, this essay is about specifically teaching as a white person, your Black son, about what Blackness means, especially in Trump's America. But it kind of inspired me to do the reverse thinking of, like, how am I going to talk to my children about whiteness when, where,
yeah,
obviously, I'm not necessarily obviously, but I'm not planning to have children anytime soon. But it's still something that I feel like
it's not going to go away. Like,
up. I don't know if there's any bullet points that or aha moments that I had from this, but reading it was a reminder that that's going to be something that I can start thinking about now, or just reflecting on how I learned about privilege, basically, which was pretty late because I'm a pretty privileged person.
I thought about the way she, and this is less about teaching children going forward, because like I personally am not, truly cannot think that far ahead. I'm
legit
still working on myself. And in that, she's been learning since she was, you know, very small about all the things that her family, her grandparents and great-grandparents went through. And I'm still thinking about the fact that up until how many years ago? 6 years ago, if you had asked me when I was 18 and, like, had just graduated high school and hadn't gone to school, I would have been like, yeah, racism seems like it's over, right? Compared to... well, a lot of these essays, and someone who's got a lot less privilege than me. I'm, like, pretty new to this. So I feel like I'm still doing a lot of, like you said, like, the opposite, where you took it and thought about how you would teach your kids about whiteness. I feel like I'm still learning about how I deal with that.
Oh, me too. Totally.
Yeah, I thought of it more through that lens. And also, strangely enough, thought about how I might talk to my family, my white family, about this. Because, I mean... my family is smart, and they're not bigots, but are they accidentally racist too? Probably, I'm sure they move through the world in a similar way that I did until I was, I mean, that I still do, but with a similar mindset that I might have had a few years ago. I feel like I'm not giving them enough credit, but you know what I mean.
No, I definitely know what you mean, and I just think it's...
people who are older and who are living in a very white space, and who are very white.
And I guess... thinking about, like, personal reflection, it also makes me think about maybe instances, not that I do everything right now, because I don't, and I still am oppressive in certain spaces, etc., and I think many of us are, but I think about ways that I may have hurt people of color who were my age when I was growing up, and how I can, if I do have kids, or even if I'm just working with kids, I, like, I'm not going to have nieces or nephews myself, but, you know, cousins, whatever, like, how I can make sure that maybe the white kids in my life aren't hurting children of color, or are like, a little more aware than maybe I was. And that doesn't necessarily only apply to race. I think that applies to, you know, class.
Yeah.
Like, that comes up a lot in school, too, or just, like, when you're a kid in ways that you don't understand, and just, like, how the immensity of those conversations... beginning to think about how you would break that down for a child. Or, again, like, people who just maybe don't know the same things that I do or haven't had the same opportunities, really, that I have. That's really what I thought about when I was reading this.
And I think she did... it seems like until she had a black son, she might have moved through the world similarly to the way we do. Yes, she's a queer woman. That is different. But she talked about... you know, her mom saying, you know, this could happen again. It can happen. I never should have doubted my mother's warnings that what happened in Europe in the 1930s and 40s could happen again. That it could happen here. A nation where so many sought refuge from fascist regimes and so many were turned away. And so soon. And she does mention her own privilege and, you know, wanting to not necessarily teach her son that his blackness, that to connect blackness and oppression, but then state the caveat that, like, maybe that's her own privilege talking to think that that could be done. She really does, she works through with some of her own privilege in here. And
I mean, the quote that I referred to obliquely and that you were just talking about too is, my concern is that I don't want to braid racism so tightly with racial identity the way my mother proudly did with anti-Semitic persecution in Judaism. But I worry that that's my white privilege talking.
Okay, so we're going to talk about Country Crock by Samantha Irby. She grew up in Chicago in a very liberal suburb of Chicago, title case, and moving to live in rural Michigan with her wife. She's a woman of color. Her wife is a white woman, and they're in a small rural town. And she writes this essay from more of a comic angle, but grappling with what happens when she moves from a place where she feels fairly safe to move about the world, even though she does have, you know, she comes across microaggressions all the time. Those microaggressions might just be straight up aggressions, and she has to actually fear for her safety in a way that she didn't really feel like she had to as much when she lived in Chicago. So I think this essay stood out for me a little bit because she writes in a very different way than pretty much anyone else in the book. I think she's a comedian.
It's interesting to me that you say it was about the writing style, because I actually made the wrong assumption that you hooked onto it because it's about someone moving to a small Midwestern town, which is where you're from.
The first time I read through it, I think I was drawn more by the style. I read it again, and then while I read it, I was thinking about the prejudgment she's giving a more rural space in America that might not be fair, but also I'm not a Black queer woman living in that space.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are people who are not violent bigots in rural America, but like if you're moving from Chicago and you're coming from a very different place than I am, I can see why it might feel different.
Yeah, I think to me, my reaction was I'm from like a small city, I wouldn't call it rural, but it's not like an urban center. More than half of the population is from a college campus. So it's basically a large college town, and around it is entirely rural. And so I, on one hand, like, I don't want to say like I have a rural experience, but on the other hand, like I don't really consider myself like an urbanite.
Right.
One thing that I've read some critiques about, not about this book, but just in general, big quotes, rural America, is that a lot of rural America does have a lot of people of color. And so this particular place doesn't, what we often think of doesn't, we never see that story.
Right.
And that is not to fault Samantha Irby at all.
No.
And also, again, we said this is like one of the most, to my eyes at least, one of the most like intersectional, like diverse collection of essays I've ever seen. So I'm not really going to fault it for not representing that. But I do wish that there was more of that perspective to read, and that this, again, it's 23 women, and I guess one other essay, the one by Rhonda Girard, talks about moving through rural spaces.
Yeah.
But besides that, we don't necessarily have that grounding of a rural base, which is a lot of our countries.
Yeah.
It's a little bit about the framing for me.
Yeah, and when you say that, and this, again, is not to fault her or the way she approached this, in a book with so many perspectives, so little comes from anyone even moving through a rural space, much less in a rural space, and God knows there's lots of reasons why many of these women and these people wouldn't want to live in rural spaces. It's very valid that you don't want to stay living there for matters of safety and opportunity and myriad reasons. But again, we don't have a lot of it. And like you said, there are populations of color in rural America. They are growing. I guess it bothers me a little bit that of all the rural, of the two little looks at rural America that we get, they're pretty overwhelmingly negative in this book. And again, they both come from queer women of color. Valid. But I guess I was kind of, when I was reading it, and I know she's trying to be funny. She doesn't talk so much about things that have actually happened to her in rural America. She talks about seeing people in red hats and, quote, an American worker who loves winning, which I thought was funny.
Mm-hmm.
But she does, and maybe she does have the experience to back this up, but it just, to me, it felt a lot of like, okay, so you're going in thinking what everyone else thinks it is.
Mm-hmm.
Which might not be wrong, but maybe try. She's talking about something really personal, like feeling safe, but doing it through a lens of comedy. But the lens of comedy, I don't think quite lands. It feels really surface level.
Mm-hmm. At the very end, she says, "You just scoff at the latte lady and roll your eyes behind her back as you mumble shit about microaggressions under your breath and hope that the Land Rover she left idling in the middle of the street has a ticket on it when she goes back out there." Here she's speaking about her experiences in Chicago or like a more urban area. And then she says, "But I'm not used to this other kind of bold racism just yet. The kind that screams, the person wearing this red hat might actually hurt you." And so she's talking about that very like personal, very real threat. Not that microaggressions can't be a real threat,
right,
but maybe the meaning isn't intentional. And so I think, again, I'm seeing a little bit more about what you're talking about with the tone, where it's until we get to that zoomed in, like, this hurts, this is really scary.
Yeah.
It does feel a little, this is what I expected and that's how it is.
Yeah. It feels like one of those times when you're scared and you're hiding it.
Mm-hmm.
She's joking about how someone was like, "Oh, are you new here?" But she was terrified and ran away. And it's like, okay, well, he maybe just like hadn't seen you in the neighborhood before.
There's not enough context.
Yeah, there's a lot of little bits. And, oh, the country has its perks. Gas is approximately 37 cents a gallon. Ha, ha, ha. And then in, like, that last page, you're like, oh, so this is what you're really talking about. But you weren't actually talking about it.
Yeah, and I think it's really, like, to me, it just seems like it's a problem of not enough writing about rural America in general, which many people have said. And not even just writing, like, representations, blah, blah, blah. And it does feel like it's written for someone who's lived in the city. One of the other essays that we want to talk about is A Nation Groomed and Battered by Rebecca Solnit. And then We Have a Heroin Problem by Karina Chicano. I added the second one late, but it's talking about what people who supported Hillary faced online primarily.
So this is going straight into it, but
please.
I still, a year after the election, and I don't know if it was in this essay or if it was in Rebecca Solnit's essay where she talks about having to like throw in the caveat every time you say you like Hillary Clinton, where you're like, I know she's not perfect, but where like Bernie Sanders supporters are just like, fuck yeah, Bernie, he's perfect. I think it's worthwhile to think about why you support a candidate. And especially in this election to like think about all the things that have happened. But it took, honestly, years before I was like, no, you know, I like Hillary Clinton, and I support her. And even after I was like, yeah, okay, I feel like I know enough now, and like, cool, let's do this. I still didn't really mention it, because whenever I did, just some guy, honestly, just like has so many reasons why you shouldn't, and it's exhausting.
That's what, like, Karina Chicano talks about, Rebecca Solnit talk about. I think we can kind of talk about their essays, like, in a pair, even though they are very different, but for the thematic element.
Yes.
I mean, I'm definitely one of the people who, I voted for Hillary, but I had a lot of buts. No regrets, but buts, for sure. But then also, like, the fact that any proclamation of support for Hillary Clinton, especially in an election like this one, needed to have a butt attached, was something I saw play out on social media a lot. And I actually wish that I had been more public about my support of Hillary Clinton than I was. And so I didn't experience any of this personally. It just was more like if someone asked me who I was voting for, I was like, duh.
Yeah.
And tried to talk to people about it. But I didn't really, I wasn't really engaged with her social media or necessarily people in her campaign, like Zerlina Maxwell, who's also in this collection, by the way. But I saw it all the time. And it was coming from a very particular set of people, a lot of whom were Bernie bros. Not to say that all Bernie supporters are bros.
And not all Bernie supporters are like this.
Part of what it was like, you would be on Twitter and you'd say something like, I support Hillary. And then it would be like a deluge of 500 tweets. And then it would be like, but what about this? But what about this? But what about this? Whereas you're just making a very personal, like, quiet statement that shouldn't have to be personal or quiet.
Right.
But even that super low-key from a rando on Twitter is met by a garbage pile.
Yes.
And then you add on to that someone who has a platform who says anything relatively positive that's not even, I'm voting for Hillary, but probably is, but it's just Hillary did something right this one time, and it's like garbage. And a lot of it's misogynist garbage.
Yeah.
Karina's talking about that. Karina Chicano in her essay. She's talking about a lot of it coming from progressives. And the majority of it, the stuff that she faced was coming from progressives. She talks about this like particular post that she had that she doesn't even really remember. But someone responded in a swift and toxic fashion.
That could be the tagline for Twitter.
Swift and toxic. Yeah, and that he was a liberal creative type from San Francisco, about a decade my senior, and she barely knew him. But somehow he was all up in her space, trying to shut her down and push her out.
I don't use Facebook for a lot of political posts, just I feel like that kind of stems from the age I was when I got it, the age I am now. But when I do, I'm always surprised by some of the reactions and understand why people with, you know, maybe more friends on Facebook or who might post more often, like, what they must have to deal with. Because I posted one thing about Hillary Clinton. I don't remember what it was about. I don't think it was anything. Again, it, like, was not consequential. And this person from my high school, who I barely spoke to in high school, he comes in here commenting all up on my posts, and maybe it wasn't toxic, but it was swift and it was not positive. Where the hell did you come from? How are we still friends?
The audacity of that mindset is beyond me.
Stranger I've barely spoken to.
Anyway, so is there anything unique to Rebecca's?
Honestly, I think I identified with it because it was nice to read someone just be like, yo, this is some bullshit. There's a reason she can't be sad or angry, but she also can't be happy or amused, but she also can't refrain from expressing any of these emotions. She just put into a nice little essay all the things that I still feel really angry about mm-hmm. Hillary not being taken seriously.
Yep.
The kinds of things when people are like, it's not because she's a woman. And I'm like, okay. I really appreciated that Rebecca Spillman put it all in there. And I was like, yes, okay. Everything else is making me think very critically and in a good way. And this one, I was just like, I'm not imagining this. It is ridiculous. It always has been. Rebecca just goes for it. And I appreciate it.
I think that Rebecca Spillman, one of the things that she does really well is that, first of all, her arguments are always just bulletproof entirely.
Oh, yeah.
Like, her writing is just so tight. And then also she's always talking on a systemic level, very broad terms, backing it up times 10.
Yeah.
And Karina's is also very powerful and is talking about a pattern, but it does start with like a very personalized anecdote that draws you in and is really effective.
Yeah.
But the writing style of it is different in terms of catharsis. I could see how this is how it is from the get-go, laid all out, is really validating.
I really like that. And like, we shouldn't ignore the fact that 53% of white women voted for Trump. We should not ignore that.
Ever.
But can we talk about that more on a white level than on a woman level? Because she, and Rebecca talks about this, women were hated for not having gendered loyalty. But here's the fun thing about being a woman. We were also hated for having gendered loyalty. Across every racial category, more men than women voted for Trump. We should reflect on it. Definitely. But once in a while, could we just like not for 1 second make it a women's fault that Trump got elected?
I also think it bothers me because it's like white men are beyond hope.
Yeah.
Which I understand why a lot of people would feel that way.
It feels like that sometimes.
But like, I mean, like, as someone who
they don't get a pass
should be responsible for talking to white men and dealing with this issue and having those conversations with other white people, I don't think they should be getting a pass, and I don't think it should be taken for granted, even if it is following a trend. I would also argue that white women voting for Trump is kind of following a trend too, and shouldn't have been surprising.
No.
Unfortunately. And I don't think either of us were necessarily surprised by that.
Absolutely not.
And it's totally something to focus on. And especially I think when we're talking about feminism or we're talking about misogyny, in those conversations it's important to say
intersectionality.
Exactly. It's important to say like, but white women, like, you can't claim to be the victim in this way and then also ignore this trend.
Definitely.
But in overall conversations, I totally agree that there should be at least more of this. But white people, including white men, did this, and it's not okay.
And I think, but there's a little more talk about, hey, you know why white women voted for Donald Trump? Because patriarchy? Not to forgive any and all sins and be like, well, it's not your fault because the patriarchy. There are larger systems at play, and also some people are just assholes. That's totally true.
And again, I think in the context of talking about feminism, this is really important, but like, voting for white men who oppress people of color has benefited white women. This is no surprise. There is a reason that those women did it.
I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about it, but the way I brought into play a lot of times, oh, but it's white ladies' fault too. Yeah, like, we know. You're preaching to the choir. The people you're telling this to are probably not people who voted for Donald Trump. The women who voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah, 53%.
They're like, cool, awesome.
Yeah.
We're not going to think that anymore because Donald Trump's the president. Yeah. They're like buying coffee cups and shit that say that on there.
And many of them probably may identify with the word feminist and whatever that means to them, but many of them probably don't. I personally, like, don't often enjoy Rebecca Solnit's writing.
I don't always, but I did like this. This quote, and I've come to believe, Sadie Doyle wrote, that in some ways saying nice things about Hillary Clinton is a subversive act. And let's calm down. Some strong wording. But also, it's more subversive than it should be because she's a woman who has a lot of experience and she's not
sorry about everything all the time.
Yeah.
Or saying that she's sorry about everything all the time.
Yeah.
I want to mention really briefly, because this is also like a departure from the writing style of a lot of the pieces, what you thought of X Country by Renda Jor, and I want to preface that by saying that it's spelled X, like the letter, and then country, like C word, a Muslim American woman's journey. What you thought about it?
Yeah, I actually just read this on the metro on the way here. It's less of a, here's an essay about the election, and more how a Muslim American woman's journey, how she moved through the world before and after the election.
For listeners, it's almost like stream of conscious. Like, not totally, but it's about Renda Jarrar's road trip through America and how different places kind of impacted how she felt and how she was perceived. And then also, of course, tying that into, it happens in the summer of 2016 is when it begins.
Yeah.
And so, like, the election season. And it's just short little paragraphs broken apart from each other. It was really interesting to me. I think this was, I read basically everything she writes, as listeners will know. I read, one other essay that she wrote for BuzzFeed that felt this way. But this one felt like it was written for a different audience than I think some of her other fiction does, which I think is necessary for this book. Throughout the piece, she mostly talks about Arab identity, but it's subtitled Muslim American Woman's Journey.
Yeah.
And Renda is Muslim and Arab, so obviously both of them apply. It was interesting that the title was Muslim, and then a lot of it, when she's talking about being seen and her friendships and her relationships, is more rooted in being Arab and being Palestinian in particular. In some ways, I think that the conversation has rightly been about Muslim, the experience of being Muslim and Muslim American in the U.S. around the election. But the framing was just interesting. Because she mentions that she's Muslim in here, but, like, it's not the focus to me.
Yeah, she mentions a lot more often her Arab identity and Palestinian identity.
And that might honestly just be because Renda doesn't wear a hijab. She might not be I think a lot of people think that they're the same thing, but I think more people may perceive her to be Arab. And I think it's in this essay, actually, where she talks about sometimes seen as white.
Yeah, she talks a lot about it in this essay. I was actually surprised.
I've never seen her talk about that either.
Yeah. She talks about being pulled over. They saw her hair and they pull her over, and then they realize she's white and they're like asking about her dog and stuff. And then,
or they saw her as white.
Right, sorry.
No, totally.
And then like getting cited for drinking beer not near a pool, and the officer writes down that she's white on the ticket and she corrects him. He leaves it.
Yep.
And like, it comes up a lot that people see her as white, but she also calls herself Arab a lot of times. She uses like the phrase my Arab body a lot of times, which it's a different feel than the rest of the essay.
Yeah, definitely.
Not the essay, the essays.
And that's one of the things that she actually talks about her body a lot, and like being a fat person too, and what that means. So I think that was kind of like tied into her like physicality as an Arab person. Like at the beginning, she says, my friend, the poet M, came to the island to visit me. He has written books of poetry and works in tech and is Arab. He is one of my others. You recognize these people, siblings you have never met, the siblings you would choose if you chose siblings. There's a misprint in this.
Oh.
There's a copy, sorry. Friends without benefits, as M would say. We are both fat and beautiful, which is pretty gorgeous. It's interesting because it takes you through a journey. It has the most geographical span of anything in the books.
Yeah, she starts in, is it Seattle, and ends in Connecticut at her parents' home. Her parents' neighbors all have Trump signs in the yard.
This is really great, too. She's talking about all the kind of the events that led up to the election, even if they weren't necessarily obviously related.
Mm-hmm.
But she talks about hearing the news about Alton Sterling and the fact that she's in a hotel from the 1800s built by black people. She says, Alton Sterling dying, being murdered every minute on the news over and over again. Palestinian children in white burial cloth, black and brown bodies wishing they weren't on the news. Mothers wishing they didn't live in an empire under the thumb of one, an empire that depends on the myth of their resilience.
That whole bit, where she's listening to the white bartender complain to another bartender who has to emotionally massage his pain, and I was like, oh, what's his pain about? And then it was just that he thought he was going to be on the news, and then he wasn't.
Yeah.
She was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, thanks for providing the additional context.
Yeah. Not quite independent of that, but like the next page when she's talking about, as she is driving through the country, she drives through New Mexico. She drives through reservations and she talks about where those reservations got their names. But later she sees signs along the way and say, you know, leaving this reservation, leaving another reservation. And she says, no sign welcoming drivers to the nations and reservations, which I love. you are not welcome here. We'll let you know when you're wanted, which is never. And I was like, oh shit, yeah. She mentioned the signs earlier in the essay, and I was like, huh, it was just like 3 different leaving signs in a row. There was no talk about the welcome sign. And then the second time she's going through reservations, she's like, I like that she explains why it's not there.
She comes back to it.
I was like, oh shit, that's a good one.
Yeah. Oh, actually, here's something that stands out in this, rightfully so. No, nobody in this collection is necessarily talking about, there's not a lot of buts, like I support Hillary, but in here, Brenda says, Hillary was officially nominated by the DNC last night. Everyone who spoke ahead of her these past few days, especially the people of color, the Hans, Astrid Silva, etc., was so much more interesting than her. Why, I keep thinking, why would our next president be someone who is married to an ex-president? The way power in our country remains in a fixed place angers me.
I didn't like that. The point about the people talking might be more interesting in her. That could be true. I do think she's an interesting person, and I also think that when you're running for president, you don't necessarily get to be the most interesting person, especially if you're Hillary.
Yeah.
You, like, don't get to really do anything. You can't, you know, be sad or happy or emotional, but you can't be not emotional. Yeah. And also, why the fuck does it matter that I get that it matters, but I'm pissed that it matters who she's married to, because, like, she's clearly made her own path.
No, I agree with you.
I understand, because in the last 30 years, we've had 2 Bushes, and a third one ran, and God, I only wish you were the president now. And so it is weird, but it's also been a bit, and she has the experience in her own right. She's not running based on being the wife of Bill Clinton.
If there was a deeper point, it could have been expanded on. I'm not gonna, like, question Brenda's feelings about it or anything, me, maybe it's misplaced. Obviously, it's a problem that power stays with certain kinds of people, and that a lot of our presidents share a lot of characteristics, whether it's familial or not.
Yeah. This one paragraph could be another essay that I might not react so viscerally to. And I mean, the point is not, like, for her to write, so I don't react viscerally to it. I know
that. And you can also just not like it and not agree with that.
Yeah,
without,
I'm, like, good with the rest of the essay. I was just like, oh.
Yeah, this isn't my favorite part of it either. It's interesting because it's, like, one of the complaints about Hillary that makes it into these essays. Again, rightfully so. And it doesn't feel like a strong one.
If you want to talk about the way power moves from person to person, like you said, there's a lot of things to talk about. But is this the biggest one? No. Is this the only one that can be attributed to the woman who's made it the farthest? Yes. It took her being married to a president and being in our minds for 25, 30 years for us to let her try.
Yeah.
It's one way to think about it. This idea is interesting. Talking about, like, how power moves from person to person, not necessarily familial.
Yeah.
But just maybe not popped in. It seems like it's just, like, plopped in.
Yeah.
Like, if she wanted to make a bigger point about the people who spoke the DNC, I think that's there.
Yep.
But I also didn't watch the speeches. Let's be real, that sounds kind of boring.
I want to close with another quote from Brenda's piece. Again, like, it's just a very different writing style, and it's, of course, very personal. But one of the passages at the very end is, later, when Trump wins, I'll imagine in a terrifying fever dream, she and the other neighbors, who she spoke about in the previous section, neighbors who are, you know, come to say hi, but are...
Well, they're Trump supporters. They have the signs.
They're Trump supporters, but, like, seem nice. And they basically say, look at your family. You guys are just like everyone else, hardworking and kind. Basically, like, you're not like those Muslims. But anyway, in the later paragraph, she says, she and the other neighbors watching his fascist police drag my father's Parkinson's addled body out of his house, our house. I'll imagine my son and me back in the basement where we used to live when he was a baby. This time he's an adult, and I have to make believe he's my servant to keep him alive. Which, again, she's alluding to the fact that her son is perceived very differently than she is. And then also just, like, how personal this all is. And I thought it was a really heartbreaking and beautiful way to end it. And right after that, she says, I have crossed the entire country, and I am nowhere near home. And that's the end of it.
I got some serious chills on that bit when she says, I have to make believe he's my servant to keep me alive. I was like,
yeah, I know. It's really powerful. The next and final essay that we're going to talk about really briefly is Trust Black Women. It's by Zerlina Maxwell, who worked on the Hillary Clinton campaign. And that's the reason that I wanted to talk about it just briefly, is, like,
it's about her experience and how she felt that Hillary Clinton was there for Black women when a lot of people didn't, and how like she saw that reiterated in the campaign mm-hmm. over and over again from the inside. And she brings up that so much of the staff did consist of Black women, women of color, and this is just the opposite narrative that I've heard a lot.
Yeah. So,
and it's really important to hear it from her because she was there.
So I didn't know her. I read her name, but I did not know who she was. And I'm reading a page in, and then she's like, the decision to dedicate 10 months of my life to Hillary's 2016 presidential campaign was easy. And I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah.
Wait. She's like, let's be real. She's been in the politics since the 60s and 70s. Girl's not always been perfect. And then, like, a page later, she's like, so, I worked for her campaign. I was like, oh, shit. I didn't expect that. I thought this was a really cool essay that I did not expect.
Me neither.
Full of stuff that I don't feel like I hear that much about.
Yeah, and I mean, it's sad to me that I'm just learning who Sirleena Maxwell is, because I don't think that's anything to do with, I'm sure that she spoke a lot, but I don't think she was amplified by a lot of people, or at least not people in my circle.
Do you know what her role was?
So she was formerly the director of progressive media for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign.
We just, like, don't hear this part.
No, and I...
Not surprised that we
don't
hear
it. I wish I'd read it beforehand. Because I feel like this was one of my butts that wasn't coming from direct experience, but was, well, but I feel like she's done a lot of things that harm Black people, which, again, she has and has had a long career. That doesn't excuse any of it. Mm-hmm. And she has done things that have really hurt Black communities, but I didn't seek out Black people in Hillary's campaign. And the narrative that I heard, or I guess read, was that Black people are voting for her because the alternative is terror, basically. So I wish I'd read it. Maybe not the same essay because it's like a reflection on the campaign, but I wish that I had known about her and had read a little bit more of this, or like sought out more people from inside the campaign to follow.
The narrative that I definitely heard, in addition to the, you know, Hillary's history with Black populations, which is varied and not great in many ways. The narrative all the time was Hillary uses Black women as tokens. She mentions them in speeches and that's all she does.
One of the things that I started to realize later on was that she, more than most politicians, I can see her grow. Change her mind. That's often demonized in politics, but in the end, don't we want people to change and like not have the same opinion for 30 years and maybe recognize that they did wrong things?
Yeah.
I don't know enough to think that she did all the right things or supported all the right policies that would have done good things for Black communities, but at the same time, she definitely has grown and was making steps to be better.
Changing in politics is demonized, you know, flip-flopping on this and that. Because if you just change your mind and on the flip of a coin, or you don't ever talk about why you changed your mind, that's not great. But I definitely feel like, first of all, it's been a longer period of time. And also, I mean, she's a politician, so she is judicious with her words when people ask her. But people ask her, like, so how about this stuff?
Yeah.
How about all of these things that hurt me and my community and communities all over the country? And she'll answer the questions. At least she acknowledges.
Yep, she does.
Is it the world's most honest answer? Well, no. Because again, she's still a politician.
Yeah,
I think you make a good point. She's changed more, but not always, and not necessarily in a bad way.
Well, I feel like she has progressed. Which is kind of what I want from a politician. I don't want a flip-flopper, because I want to know who I'm voting for, but I want someone who's growing and progressing.
With the rest of the world. The world today is not the world 30 years ago. It's not the world 30 years before that. It's really great that she's not thinking about things the same way she might have in 1988, because that wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
We can apply this to other people, too. I guess I can learn from that.
Before we move on, I just wanted to pull one quote out of this one. Basically, I think everyone should read the whole book, but people should read this too. It's talking about how Black women were at the center of Hillary's campaign. Zerlina Maxwell quotes Nisha Blandon, the campaign's national deputy women's vote director, when she says, "It's no mistake that Shirley Chisholm, a Black woman, was the first woman to run for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination. Black women have been part of every great movement that has happened in this country. We always show up, and we showed up on November 8th for Hillary. We will continue to show up over the next 4 years." So I just wanted to talk about this because it was a big eye-opener for me about the campaign in particular.
Yeah.
We're going to move on. Okay.
Talk about books.
Talk about books. Other books. Next up is, what are you reading next?
I have a pile of books from the library. I requested them and was shocked when I arrived and there was not one, but six. So I'm probably going to go from this to like a thriller,
yeah,
murder mystery type of thing. It's probably pretty generic. The name is something like, "I Left You Here" or something. It's light and I'll be done with it in like 3 days. Mm-hmm. And then I'm really excited to read Swing Time, which I've been staring at that cover at bookstores for like
it's
a year
really
now
pretty.
And haven't bought it because I don't buy books.
So I'm going to read Whereas by Lily Long Soldier after this, which is a poetry book. It's published by Grey Wolf, which is based in Minnesota, and it's the publishing house I love. And then Lily Long Soldier is a Native American woman who's gotten a lot of praise for this, tons and tons of praise for her work in general, but then also this specific poetry collection. And I have never read any of her work, and I've had a lot of recommendations. She's an Oglala Lakota poet. She seems really cool, and I'm excited to read her work. And then our next item is an action item. I have several. Some of them are book-related. Most of them aren't. But, you know, this is an election kind of themed episode. So one of them is that I want to have, like, a get-together on the anniversary date and just, like, talk through with people, like, I've had these conversations literally every friend I have about like where I was on election night and the whole process.
Oh my God.
But even though I've repeated it at least 5 times to all my closest friends, it's so really like freeing every time I talk about it. So I'd like to just like get together with people on that day. And then aside from that, I want to talk to people about voting because we're coming up on elections and that's important. And I just did my research for Virginia.
I was just going to ask you.
Yeah, so I'm voting in Virginia, which is a purple state, and I'm very excited. So
it's a year.
It's a year, yeah. So people should vote no matter where you are if you're able to vote. And then my book-related action item is I discovered that Book Riot, which is a site that I really like, actually has action items, which I didn't know when I created the podcast. So it had nothing to do with it, but people should check out their action items. They're really great, and they're doing... Layla Roy and Kelly Jensen are doing Fundum Fridays, where they pull together GoFundMe pages from various schools coming from teachers who are saying, my students need books, or even my students need toiletries or like warm weather gear or whatever. And so I'm going to follow the GoFundMe series that they do, and then I'm going to contribute as I can because I think it's really cool. So people should also follow that, and I'll put it in the show notes.
Well, my action item, 2 years ago maybe, I started keeping track because I find it satisfying to keep track of how many books I'm reading and like, who wrote them. Also because I figured it was probably important to figure out how many books I'm actually reading, first of all, by women, because it's shocking when you're not thinking about it, how few you might be reading. Mm-hmm. And then people of color. And I feel like I'm doing pretty okay at that. I've read 2 books by men, and I'm like, cool.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, I'm like, cool. I mean, it's not even super conscious anymore. Yep. I just say, it's cool. But I'm struggling, and I'm sure the internet can tell me pretty easily. I want to read more books by LGBTQ people, but finding that out without just not going to like Google the author and be like, are they LGBTQ? Because not every author maybe has it as part of their central
bio or identity.
Yeah.
Like something that they like shelve their books as.
Right. I know that the information and the resources that are out there, I have friends who I'm sure would love to give me a list. I just haven't done it.
Actually, I mean, this is a great opportunity. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to an article written by our mutual friend, Cassidy Faust. Now we're going to talk about book and publishing news. And this month, I've combined the good and the bad into one kind of gigantic thing, which is the 2016 Vita Count, which comes out and we're here, which is why it has the name in the title. And this looks at how women are being represented in publishing, important publications, how many women are writing for them, and then also breaking down other identities that those women have. And so I put this as good and bad because there tends to be more representation of women in some of the biggest publications. So like they talk about, you know, the Paris Review, Poetry, New Republic, The Atlantic, kind of growing, but also like not enough, pretty small, mostly white. So
yeah.
Small gains need to be bigger gains. And I think it's a really important read because just like you're talking about, like maybe not even realizing how many men you're reading.
Yeah.
Or how many white people you're reading or whatever mm-hmm. it may be, especially with these publications.
Yeah.
I just don't really pay attention to bylines, essentially.
Yeah. First of all, I should pay attention to bylines for lots of reasons.
Yeah, totally.
Second,
yeah.
I cannot believe The Atlantic only has 36%
yep.
of writers are women.
That surprised me, too.
Definitely going to check this out. And I'm not just saying that for the podcast.
Yeah, I'll definitely link to it in the show notes. I think everybody who listens should at least take a look at it. Of the places that Vita looked at, there were 23 publications that they looked at in total, and 11 of them published as many bylines by women writers as men or more.
Damn.
So that's exciting. That would include The Normal School, Prairie Schooner, Colorado Review, lots of other places. Important to note that most of these are fiction or poetry publications, so not The Atlantic. Journalism. So
still cool. But
still
like,
very cool, but kind of sequestered.
Yeah.
And then as part of their intersectional survey, they also talk about women and non-binary writers of color who make up various bylines and staff at publications. In The Atlantic, 33% of survey respondents, so again, from a particular pool within the publication, important to say, 33% of survey respondents identify themselves as Jewish by ancestry, but none identify themselves as Hispanic, Latinx. 6% of respondents reported as Asian, but none as Black, multiracial, or Indigenous.
I think this is just for women and non-binary writers.
Yes.
So it's like
Thank
a
you.
Smaller pool. So for The Atlantic, they had a smaller pool, like 36% or something.
Yeah.
And then the respondents,
that,
I mean, that's still really low.
And then there's also a disability Vita count, a sexuality Vita count, trans women and non-binary writers count, ageism and academic access.
This is awesome.
And there's
they have an infographics.
And it's super tweetable. So maybe I'll tweet
some
of these.
Super tweetable.
That's a little thing. Check it out. And thanks to Vita for doing this because I think it's really important work and I'm always excited when this happens, when it comes out, that is. And then just because the world sucks, I found a really fun quiz on bookriot.com. It's not actually a quiz, it's an article that outlines which genre you should read based on your Myers-Briggs.
It seems really on brand that you'd be like, because the world sucks, here's a fun thing. It's a Myers-Briggs article. I mean, I'm on board with it. I'm really excited about it.
Love Myers-Briggs.
Okay, so I am INFJ, also INTJ, the F and the T. Every time I take the quiz, they're like, we can't decide which one you are.
Okay, so maybe this one, INFJ, is fantasy.
Let's see the TJ.
It does list Harry Potter as perfect for you, though.
Harry Potter's perfect for, like, a generation.
Nope. Very good point.
There we go. That's
it. INTJ is mystery.
Mysteries. Here's a massive list of amazing mystery books. Let's go.
And then I get ENFJ is religion, spirituality, and new age, which, honestly, I don't read a lot of right now, but does feel, like, pretty on brand.
ENFJ seems to be disproportionately represented among cult leaders. This does not necessarily mean that you will become a cult leader if you explore this subject. Please don't.
That's it for our show. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It's been delightful, and thanks for reading this with me, too. I like as soon as I read it, I needed about 10 people to digest it with me.
Yeah.
So thanks for being the first one to digest it with me and to share it with the listeners.
It's one of the first books I've bought in a while because I've really stopped myself from doing that.
Yep.
And the DC Library is great.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
And bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 9. As you heard, Nasty Women is an incredible collection. I suggest that you purchase it for yourself and everyone in your circle online at Square Books of Oxford, Mississippi. You can find a direct link in the show notes. The song you've heard in this episode is called Petrichor and is by Rachel Rostad. The beautiful cover art is by Abaki Beck. Thank you to my friend Aileen Clark for coming on the show and for making me laugh as usual. Remember to follow her on Twitter at @_AileenClark. If you like this podcast, you should listen to Feminasty, hosted by the collection's editors. In addition, you should catch up on Raquel Willis's podcast, BGD. On it, Raquel talks about, in her words, current events, pop culture, and whatever the hell else is happening on social media, discussed from a dope intersectional lens. If you're a new listener, drop me a line at xmarginalia@gmail.com and let me know what you think. I'd love to hear listener thoughts and look forward to hearing from you. Please follow the show on Twitter at @ex_marginalia and on Goodreads at @xmarginalia. You've heard it before, but reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts helps so, so much. If you want to support our work right now, that's the way to do it. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time, read, resist, repeat.